Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers. Hi, it's Richard Edelman. I'm CEO of Edelman, and today I'm joined by Daniel Dearmeyer, Chancellor of Vanderbilt University, a post he's held since 2020. Before that, he served in academic institutions, leadership roles at Stanford Graduate School of Business, Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern, and the University of Chicago, where he was provost. And he's a renowned political scientist, also a scholar with particular expertise in reputation management. He and I have worked on trust for many years. So, Chancellor Dearmeyer, let's get right to the reality. This is the beginning of school. And a week ago, you stood before your student body and you told hundreds of new students what the school wouldn't do, would not divest from Israel, would not banish provocative speakers, would not issue statements in support of or condemning Israel or Palestinian causes. You also said Vanderbilt will not tolerate threats, harassment, or protests disrupting the learning environment. Can you give us some sense of why you decided to be so proactive on this topic?
Thank you very much for having me, Rich. It's good to talk to you. We spent some time with our incoming freshmen last week to really make sure that everybody understands exactly what our values are and what our principles are. And one of the big lessons, I think, from last year was that the most important thing to deal with these challenges is to be very clear about what your principles and values are, communicate them early and often, and then act accordingly. So when there are violations of it, you're going to have to be able to make sure that everybody understands what the rules are, but then also that the consequences for the, such rule violations. So for us, we have three pillars there. Our first pillar is what we call open forum, which is a commitment to free expression. The second is what we call institutional neutrality, which is making sure that we're not taking positions such as making statements or using our endowment for political or social issues that are not directly connected to the cooperation of the university. And the third thing is what we call civil discourse. Civil discourse is a commitment that we make as members of the Vanderbilt community to treat each other with respect, to listen, and to use reasons and arguments to try to convince each other rather than to shout each other down. So those are the three pillars. And it was very important for us to have these conversations early in the semester so that everybody is on the same page as we're entering the new school year, which, of course, in addition to having the conflict in the Middle East, is also bringing us on right before a contentious presidential election.
We had a summit to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Trust Barometer, which is in January, and you were one of the most interesting participants. I loved your phrase, effective polarization. Can you talk about this and how does that relate to what's going on campus and more broadly in the U.S. and around the world?
It was a great event. What I talked about there is like how to think about polarization in today's environment. And what's important here to understand is that most Americans fundamentally agree on many issues. There's actually a lot of consensus on many issues. And even on those issues, policy issues where there is disagreement, things have not dramatically changed. And that's true even for controversial issues, gun control or abortion. So what has changed is what political scientists call affective polarization. It's just a fancy word for we don't like each other. So that we now have a situation where the political parties, members of political parties that identify as Democrats or Republicans, do not like the other side. And so their attitudes towards the other side, irrespective on what the issues are that they're not trustworthy, that they're not moral, that they're not as intelligent, that they're not well-informed. And these numbers have gotten a lot worse. I mean, dramatically worse over the last few years. So this is less about profound disagreement on issues. It's much more kind of a tribal thing or a social psychological phenomenon where people don't like each other. And the problem, of course, is that that really undermines trust in a society. It shows up in left-right, Republican-Democrat, but we see it also right now in the conflict on campus. So if you're on one side, you just think the other side is immoral or evil or uninformed or whatever. But there is a breakdown in the ability to talk across these different groups. And that's very worrisome. And one of my faculty members has called this the rush to righteousness, which I think is a wonderful term, is that we have a tendency now is that on any issue, such as the conflict in the Middle East right now, people, and you know that's also true for young people, tend to take a side, and then that side becomes part of who they are, and it becomes an expression of their identity very often. It also makes it difficult to see the possibility that the other side has something to say as well. Dramatic reduction in the complexity of the issues. So that's why this is so problematic.
So this ideology becomes identity has also been called, I think, in your academic work, oppositional tribalism, where people conflate their opinions and feelings with moral superiority. So what role do institutions have in popping that balloon?
That's exactly right. And one of the particularly pernicious consequences of when you have this kind of form of affective polarization is you stop listening to each other. You will only select information that's in line with your position. And then even information comes in, you interpret it in a way that supports your position rather than challenges it. And we know this much less a worrisome area of with sports teams. You know, once people pick a sports team, if there's critical information about them, about the team, people kind of reinterpret it in a particular way. I mean, if you just remember the New England Patriots, the Tom Brady issue on Deflategate, a fan of the New England Patriots will think about this very differently than a fan of the New York Giants. So the problem is once you have these polarization and these tribal structures in place, psychologists, political science call this motivated reasoning, which meaning our reason is now shaped by who we identify with. And that's very problematic because the ability to have reasoned debate and discussion across these groups really deteriorates. So what can leaders and institutions do? The first thing I think really important is to make sure that when they communicate and when they are engaged in decision-making, they are not inadvertently triggering those types of polarizations, affective polarization. So I am particularly worried about that. And that is one reason for why I think the commitment to institutional neutrality is so important is because if you're supporting one side, you're alienating the other side. And you're usually alienating the other side more than you're getting support from one side. So that's number one. Number two, there are various people call depolarization strategies that one can engage in. For example, is to identify what we have in common, to have contact, to have structured conversation with the other side that erodes, if you will, and dissolves these stereotypes. And that can be very, very effective. But it needs to be done in an intentional way. And it needs to be usually be structured. If you just leave things as they are, this doesn't work very well.
One of the most stunning developments in the 25 years of the trust barometer is the emergence of business as the most trusted institution. From a low in 2008 after the financial crisis to a high point, frankly, starting in 2021 during COVID. What do you attribute this to? And do you feel that business may have too much on its plate in terms of expectations?
This is a very, very good question. And it's a very interesting finding from the trust barometer. And you and I know that not too long ago, it was kind of NGOs that were the most trusted institutions and businesses were struggling with that. But we've really seen a significant and dramatic reversal on that. So I think whenever you look at these increases in trust, right, you look at what's accounting for that. My sense is that business, that one of the key drivers of trust is this sense of competence, right, that we have trust in businesses because we know what they're doing. And then there's also a question of integrity or goodwill. Do they have our best interest in mind? I think when it comes to competence, our businesses are doing very well. And, you know, that was to a certain extent, I think, reinforced during COVID. But we haven't had in the last 4 or 5 years, the last 4 years, really a trust and competence of businesses as we had it, let's say, after the financial crisis. So that's factor one. Factor two, what's more interesting, I think, or more surprising is that there is a sense that we attribute to businesses a higher level of goodwill than we've seen that before. And, you know, we know, for example, that people really trust their CEO, the leader in their organization, that that's an important source of information on them. My sense is that it's very important that businesses utilize this kind of trust capital in a way that doesn't squander it. And my concern that I have on these in some cases is that there's overreach, is that businesses try to do too much, they try to go beyond what really their core purpose is. And whenever you do that, I think you set yourself up for problems.
Another thing that's emerged in the trust barometer over the 25 years is the mass class divide. And now in give or take 2/3 of the countries, we have between 15 and 20 points difference between the top quartile and bottom quartile in terms of trust in institutions. So what do you attribute this to, and what should we be thinking about in the coming years as to how to fix this?
Very interesting development. So my sense is that, first of all, just like you say, that this is a phenomenon we see across the board in highly developed economies and democracies. It is not just a U.S. phenomenon. And I think that people often mistakenly attribute this, that this is kind of a Trump phenomenon or anything like that. We saw this earlier in the case of Britain. Of course, Brexit was largely driven by that. When you look at the voting patterns there, we're seeing it in France and in the recent elections in France. We see it in Italy. We see it in Germany. We see it in Sweden. I mean, it's just across the board. And my sense overall is that what we're seeing are now the political consequences of massive disruption in the global economy, driven by rapid technological progress plus globalization. That has had very positive effects for the world overall, of course, especially in China and India, but many other parts of the world as well. But it has very disruptive impact on particularly, you know, blue-collar employees, workers in developed economies that were often not the winners of this development. And we as societies have not done a good enough job of retraining them, investing in them, so that the full brunt of these developments were born by certain population segments, often blue collar, often in industry, often in rural communities. And so what you're seeing, I think, is a reaction to a large extent of a group of people that basically are saying, this system is not working for me. And then now you have a group of leaders that are basically giving voice to that and that are saying, well, it's not your fault. The system is rigged against you and the institutions are broken and they have to be changed or ripped apart. I mean, that's basically a populist message. The populist message, we're seeing it everywhere in Europe, in Latin America, in North America. And to me, that's what it is. And now what do we do about that? What we shouldn't do is dismantle our institutions that have been the source of prosperity and peace in highly developed democracies, certainly since the Second World War. These institutions are hugely important, and we can criticize them, we can reform them, we can make changes, but we should not throw them out. And this idea that there is this additional way of how this can be done is just like, I think, a fantasy outside of an institutional structure. And then the second aspect is, what are we doing to make sure that economic development becomes more inclusive so that people can participate in the huge benefits that that globalization and technological progress has brought for so many people? And of course, you know, particularly for people that are well-educated and that are in jobs that have benefited from this. So to me, this is really a consequence of massive disruption through globalization and technological progress. But that is not a law of nature. That it has those impacts is that it's something that through policies and a commitment to institutional structures can be addressed.
One of the shocking findings of our January study this year was that people are really afraid of AI, and they're afraid of innovation more broadly. They're afraid of genetic modified foods. They're afraid of mRNA. And so, in short, the thing that historically has created more jobs, et cetera, which is R&D, people are afraid of it because of job loss or the great unknown. What should we be thinking about this? How can we also deal with the decline of belief in experts?
The fear of technologies is a well-understood psychological phenomenon by now. And you mentioned bioengineering and genetically modified food. It goes even earlier, I would say. I mean, the first time I was really seen as dramatic, I think, was with nuclear power. And the thing that was puzzling to experts, both in the genetically modified food aspect, but nuclear power or whatever really transformative technology we're looking at, the experts look at that and they say, well, the benefits so clearly outweigh the risks. Isn't it obvious? But that's not how our mind works. And there is a well-understood phenomenon on risk perception and fear. And if a particular aspect has these characteristics, then our fear goes through the roof. So for example, it is very novel. We have a sense it's uncontrollable. These are all factors that increase fear. And at that point, fear just dominates and people are literally, their reaction is a very strong emotion of rejection. For example, on genetically modified food, right, the thing that is driving up the fear is that people don't know where it's in. They don't know that it's in, you know, and what food it is and what it's not. So labeling can help with that. Giving you a sense of control can help with that. The sense that we have now with AI, I think, is that there's, again, the sense that people don't have a sense of agency, of control, and that doesn't help. Now, I should say that I think how these technologies are introduced is really important. So one important question, for example, is what are the benefits and what are the risks? So technologies that have, even if they have some risks, if they have a large amount of benefits, tend to be accepted by the public. For example, when you look at bioengineering, in medical applications, it's not controversial or not as controversial. Much more controversial in agricultural or food applications because the benefits are not clear to people. And the benefits often are cost or efficiency. And that's not anything that customers and consumers can directly experience. So the cost-benefit ratio really has to be right for people not to fear new technologies. So in the case of AI, the way these technologies were introduced were as that they can replicate in an astonishing way things that human could do, like they could write a poem for you, okay? Well, that's not a big benefit, okay? So if you're not worried that this is going to take over the world or that it will eliminate your job, the fact that it can write a poem for you is fundamentally useless. So I think what the industry has not demonstrated and should have done just from the point of view of dealing with this trust issues and fear issues is what is the benefit? What can we do this as we couldn't do before? That was never a problem with the iPhone or with search engines. It was absolutely obvious to people what you could do that you couldn't do before. But what exactly is the benefit? And so people, I think, you know, it's not obvious. And then people focus on the downside and the risks, whether that, you know, kind of Terminator like taking over the world or people losing their job.
Another development in trust over the last few years is that trust has become local in my employer. My company's CEO, my company's newsletter is the most trusted form of communication, which is pretty stunning. So it's moved from top down to horizontal now to local. So do you see this as a long-standing phenomenon or is it just a reaction to COVID?
I don't think it's just a reaction to COVID. I think it is a phenomenon that pops up, I think, in many different dimensions. It's basically the localized, I think it's the right way to think about it. It's now relative to communities. So if I'm a member of one community, then the forms of communication that are utilized in that community are more trustworthy than kind of general mass communication. We certainly see this in social media. And just as you point out, we see this with respect to company newsletters, which if you will, is a form of communication within a community. That's not shocking that this would be the case because it goes back against to kind of our social psychology, the way we form beliefs. We trust people that are like us. And so I more trust my coworkers or people that are in my social group than those that are not or those that are on the other side. I think the great accomplishment of the modern news media was through a whole variety of both technologies, but also just building credibility over time to be something, a medium that would reach many people. So if you go historically, right, before you had that, you had hundreds and literally thousands of local newspapers, often very partisan, speaking to very local groups in the United States around the turn of the century. And they were wiped out over time by the emergence of these mass news organizations. So there's nothing totally new about that. We've seen some of that before, The problem, of course, is that now you have these echo chambers even more. So you're having these group effects, and now you have new sources that speak to these group effects. You get even more of these echo chambers and this kind of affective polarization that we've been talking about. So the question is, how do we overcome that? You know, there's real challenges, of course, to business models of media right now. This is a very hard problem. And, you know, some technology may help with that. Some technology may be a problem with that. But right now, it's certainly something that we see in a whole variety of different dimensions.
As a final question, the value of optimism. Can you talk somehow about the connection between optimism and its link to trust?
Yeah, that is a very important point. So the first thing is that, you know, negative messages have a bigger impact than positive messages. So even if you had more positive messages, if you have, you know, one negative message, it kind of overcomes that. I mean, the usual people that think it's kind of a 5-to-1 ratio. A negative message has a 5 times an impact than a positive one. Very good advice in relationships too. You know, it's just like you can never overdo the positive on that. So having now on top of that more negative messages, because that sells, of course, twists the balance even more. It is so important that we accentuate the positive and the good that is not getting getting enough play. I mean, I mentioned previously the tremendous positive impact that we've seen in the last 20 years on the reduction of global poverty are just astonishing. And when you look a little bit more from a historical perspective, you know, this combination of democracy, rule of law, market economies has unleashed a level of prosperity unknown in human history. And those type of things, we tend to take them for granted, but they are enormous, enormous achievements. And it is so important we understand that even though there are real issues that we need to deal with and real problems on so many dimensions, life is so much better than it ever was in human history. And keeping that front and center, I think, gives you a sense that problems can be addressed, that we don't need to despair, and that we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater, and that these institutions that, you know, are shaking right now are really the foundation of tremendous progress that humanity has made over the last decades.
So, Chancellor Giermeier, thank you very much for being on Trustmakers, and continue your great work in academia. We deeply appreciate you.
Thank you. It was a great conversation. Very much enjoyed it. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.